Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. Your hosts are Dr. On, board-certified clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. Xander will, as usual, do the honors and introduce our guest.
Thank you, On. Yes, our guest today is Lee Beckstead. He's a psychologist. He lives in Salt Lake City, Utah. And we're going to be talking today about coping versus succumbing to minority stress, about inviting people in versus shutting people out, and just peace building, what that process is, and some of the efforts that Dr. Beckstead has been involved in those endeavors. So Lee, we're really happy to have you with us. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here. And thank you for being interested in peace building.
Absolutely. When you sent in a description of our talk today, you had written that you have been dialoguing monthly since 2013 with your political enemies about sexual, gender, and faith diversity. That's a lot. And so I thought maybe we could start off by having you tell us a little bit about what prompted this work to engage in dialogue with people you consider to be your political enemies. And maybe you could outline a little bit more for the listener, what makes one a political enemy?
Well, first for that question, the political enemy is somebody who is opposing you, who has different ideas, different experiences, different agendas than you. There's some conflict. They want something and you want something. And we think that the solution is going against attacking each other. And there's a winner and a loser. And so I think that this idea of I have to attack you so that I can win, I think is one strategy or a dominant strategy that we keep using with these people who are different and who do oppose us either politically or in the clinical field. But my work really did begin when I was a doctoral student. And with my doctoral research from 1997 to 2001, I did a qualitative study, which qualitative methods are different than quantitative methods. With qualitative methods, you really want to seek out outliers. You're looking to talk to people who will disconfirm your theory and the majority theory. And the research I was doing was on conversion therapy, trying to understand what helped people who wanted to change their sexual orientation, what helped their process, and what harmed their process. So I had to go and actually find people who said they benefited from this type of therapy. They were cured. I had to talk to them and really understand their experiences, interview them, go back and forth with my understanding, then make sure that I was understanding their experiences. And through that back and forth, I really got to understand, again, what helped them and what harmed them. I had 50 individuals. And so again, half said they were benefited, half said they were harmed. And there was a mix in between of mixed results. And so based upon that kind of research, I had to, again, dialogue with people who thought differently from me. I wanted to figure out, well, I was harmed by these methods. How could you possibly say that you benefited from them? So my curiosity, my kindness toward them, my openness really helped me to develop a wide range theory rather than an approach that would only help one side versus the other side. Because that's what was going on, that you either had to be gay or be anti-gay or ex-gay, I guess the phrase was at that time.
Well, I'm sure you're not surprised to hear me say that that is not a very common endeavor for people to pursue, to go right into the belly of the beast, as we might say.
Yeah.
To have conversation with individuals who claimed, we're going to either believe them or disbelieve them, that they benefited from something that you not only experienced as harmful yourself, but I would imagine you held an idea that it was harmful in and of itself, that to claim to be benefited by it was somehow almost like Stockholm syndrome, you know? Did you actually come to a place where you were able to believe that they believed that they did benefit, that they were helped by it?
Yeah, the labels I had before, like they're lying to us or lying to themselves, those kind of labeling and categories really got in the way of me trying to understand them. So I learned what helped them. The conversion therapy theory is that we're all heterosexuals, and those who do same-sex sexuality, we've eroticized our same-sex emotional needs. So that was one way that they were able to figure out to, in a sense, feel normal rather than feeling ashamed that there were these perverts, that they were doing something awful. They were able to find a theory that fit for them and their experiences. They also were able to talk to other individuals so they didn't feel so alone in their struggles. They were getting something to work on. And also the shame and the anxiety from feeling their attractions went down. So from that activated place of, oh, I can't feel this stuff, to, okay, this makes sense. This is who I am. I'm not a bad person. It's something that happened to me. It gave them something to work on. So it gave them some control, some options that made sense for them. And from that place of self-acceptance and community building in their own group, they were able to make choices on their attractions. And that helped them to resolve the distress that they were feeling within their religion or within their heterosexual marriages. As one individual said, you found us out, but in a very nice way.
Lee, this was about 20 years ago when you did this research.
Yeah,
right?
25 or more.
Okay. And have you done any follow-up since then?
Well, the theories stay the same about conversion therapy, and the experiences stay the same. I was an expert witness for a landmark case in 2012. It was a Jewish organization. In the end, they were found guilty of consumer fraud, of telling their clients that they could become heterosexual. So I've been engaging with people, trying to understand, again, their current experiences with this. But as Xander mentioned, I have been talking with people who were once conversion therapists, or we would label them conversion therapists. I've been dialoguing with them for the last decade or so. So I've kind of got an idea of how they've either reframed their interventions or how they were misunderstood in their interventions. I'm trying to find a wide range of approach to help everybody, not just one side or the other. There are different ways of doing this type of therapy. It can be very aggressive. It can be very passive. It can have one piece of the harmful piece and everything else is helpful. So putting everything into one box tends to be what the problem is. To answer your question, I have not done work specifically on conversion therapy and consumers of conversion therapy. I should say in 2016, I started doing a research group with my research enemies, people who were against me and my colleagues. And we developed a team and developed a survey that would work for all of us. And we sent that survey to all of our communities. Again, these communities that said that they were ex-gay or they were no longer gay, that they were heterosexuals and queer. So from this survey that had been vetted for bias and prejudice, it was able to go into communities that my affirmative group hadn't really talked to enough or didn't really get their experiences. So we, again, broadened our understanding of these experiences by working with our enemies.
If you were to reframe it, if you had an opportunity to reframe it, what would you reframe conversion therapy as?
Oh, again, they've reframed it as they're trying to help people reduce their attractions. So it's no longer about changing attractions or changing someone from a homosexual to a heterosexual. They've reframed it to exploring how fluid a person is. And in a sense, that is helpful because many, I think, clients who are distressed with their attractions don't really have an understanding of what their sexual orientation is because there's so much shame, so much avoidance, not enough exploration. So I think that kind of exploration of what is possible for somebody. But again, if you are working to change someone's attractions, that encouragement or that promise or that possibility works for some people who have that capacity to experience attractions to more than one gender. But for those who don't, that's going to cause harm. From my work with these individuals and talking with my clients and these consumers, my basic approach is to be hands-off. Whether it's a child, whether it's a client in front of me, whether whoever it is, I don't know the trajectory of this person. So I really, instead of trying to encourage or discourage a certain identity, I really can be with them and help them to figure out the path ahead. So it's a hands-off approach where I can be with the person and facilitate their unique identity development.
Lee, I'm wondering if it might be helpful for the listener to, we have listeners from all over the world. And so we're talking about a topic, conversion therapy, but maybe we could go back a little bit. What is conversion therapy? And I would imagine since you wrote a dissertation on the topic that you might be aware of some of the history, like the origins of it that might be of interest. I'm going to find it fascinating, I'm sure, but maybe we could at least define it and give a little bit of context, a little bit of history, perhaps.
Well, it's people who were either told by their therapist or told by a religious leader or told by maybe their parents, somebody that they could change their attractions. So if you feel that you're struggling with being attracted to the same sex, it's the hope that you either no longer be as attracted to the same sex or that those attractions will go away, they'll be minimized, and you'll have more heterosexual attractions. So it's a solution to a problem. I mean, I struggled with myself. I went through some type of conversion therapy. Again, a therapy an approach with the hope that I was going to change. But the methods can really be very aversive to, I mean, I think in the 1940s and 50s, it was lobotomies. I'm going to lobotomize your brain and you'll no longer be homosexual. Well, you'll be no longer sexual, or you'll be no longer a person. So that kind of a really aversive technique, also like drinking. So watching pornography or watching same-sex nudity and then drinking something that would make you throw up. It's pairing this really aversive feeling with something that you really like. So there's some behavioral conditioning. In the 80s, it shifted toward this more psychodynamic approach, that the reason why you have attraction to the same sex is because your parents did something really bad to you. They either they were distant or they were too enmeshed with you. So the focus became on this attachment insecurity. Also in the 80s, it was about you weren't manly enough. So you weren't womanly enough. So it would teach women who were attracted to the same sex, it would teach them to put makeup on and to wear high heels. And it would teach the men, the guys to play basketball or play football. So it was a sense of it was a gender inferiority. So they had these ideas about same-sex sexuality that were really based upon this deficiency model or defectiveness. So we're going to help you be like other heterosexuals, and then you'll actually feel like a heterosexual and act like a heterosexual. Again, if you're really struggling with the solution, these seem really compelling because, you know, you don't want to be a pervert or you don't want to lose your spouse and your position in your community. But if you think about, basically, it's about turning against your attractions, trying to change them rather than turn toward, accept, and be with, or live with harmony with.
When I was 15 years old, I spent a year on an adolescent psychiatric ward, a locked unit, and my psychiatrist had me do the MMPI test. I forget what those letters stand for, but it's a psychiatric assessment. And somehow my answers indicated that I was lesbian to my psychiatrist. So she engaged me in what I started to call fashion therapy. The psychiatric unit brought on to the unit an individual who worked with me exclusively. We would go into a room and they would have me put on very feminine clothing, and they would teach me how to apply makeup and how to do my hair and how to walk in high heel shoes. Then they would take me out onto the unit and they would have me walk around the whole unit, and they would encourage the male staff and the male patients to whistle and catcall and remark towards me in a way that would reinforce the positive quality of being feminine, of being a woman. And luckily, my default setting is to be quite oppositional. And so I did this thing knowing in the back of my mind that it was ridiculous. But if I did it, I would get points. And with points, I could get rewards. And so I did it because I wanted to watch Dallas on Thursday night or something like that, you know, or go have a meal in the cafeteria rather than on the unit, or go home for the weekend. So I did it. But I mean, I found the whole thing to be quite humiliating and demoralizing. And clearly, as anybody who knows me or is just listening now to my voice as a trans man on testosterone, it didn't take. It didn't take, but you know, I endured almost a year of that fashion therapy. And now it wasn't a psychiatrist and it wasn't my family, right? So it might not technically be conversion therapy, but I think it was parallel, right? It was complementary to the therapy that I was undergoing with the psychiatrist there at the hospital. Yeah, it was such a strange phenomenon. And when I talk to other people who have had conversion therapy experiences, I've never heard anybody who had one similar to mine. So they do manifest differently given the time and place and who the person is, I would imagine. But would that count as a type of conversion therapy?
Oh, a conversion approach, conversion intervention. And unfortunately, that your experience is not an outlier. That's actually what people were doing at that time. They thought they were helping. They had these ideas of what heterosexuality is and what homosexuality is and gender roles. And yes, that approach, as you said, you knew it was wrong. Other individuals are not so oppositional, probably would have taken that in and they would have thought they were the failure. You, in a sense, you were thinking, you were able to think the interventions are a failure. But you also are speaking to the problem with the research in this area, again, we really can't trust the self-reports because some individuals like yourself were saying, yes, I'm better, I'm a heterosexual, when they really weren't, because they wanted to either please their therapist, they wanted to get out of the shame, out of the probation. So that is also definitely one of the problems with the research on the benefits, so-called benefits of this type of therapy. But yeah, it's sad that that's what you had to go through. But I'm glad there was some resilience inside of you, that you stayed true to yourself and got through that.
Absolutely. You know, I remember when I first started hearing about conversion therapy, because when I went through it, it was 1981, but it was probably a little bit later. Most of the time I heard people call it reparative therapy. I didn't hear it being called conversion therapy until a little bit later. But I remember thinking at the time that it shouldn't be something that children are forced into, whether that's going to a therapist or going off to one of those tough love camps that they satirized in But I'm a Cheerleader, which is one of my favorite movies. But that if an adult came to the conclusion that they didn't want to be gay or lesbian, that part of their agency was the ability to voluntarily enter into therapy. But then I started hearing things about what was happening in the programs like Exodus International and some of the behavioral techniques, and then some of the behavior that was going on where people were just outwardly engaging in same-sex sexual behaviors while in the program with people who were running the program. I think ultimately two of the, not the founders necessarily, but two of the last set of leaders shut the whole thing down and got married to each other. And when I lived in Orlando, I met one of the gentlemen who was one of the leaders of Exodus International when it shut down. And talk about shame, so much shame about what they did and what they did in the community and to members of our community. But there's still a part of me that thinks that a person should be able to make a choice for themselves if they want to modify their behaviors. But I don't think it should be forced on anybody, regardless of age.
Well, the idea, even if it's not forced. So when I was in my 20s, I went to a therapist, I would say willingly. I volunteered to go into therapy. At this point, looking back, I really didn't have any other choice. To have a choice, you have to have a yes, this option or this option or this option, another option. And you have to think about the consequences of doing those options and not doing those options. And the only choice I had was to not be gay at the time. There was no other choice of how could I be gay and spiritual? How could I like myself being gay and spiritual? If you don't have a choice, then there's not much agency. And I like what I think John Donziorik said one time in, I think, 2004. Psychologists, we're not hairdressers. So it's not like you're going to come to me and you're going to do this for me. And I say, yeah, I'll do this. And you're on your way. That if a client comes to me and says, I don't want to be gay, first of all, I don't know of any intervention that will even do that. But even the pursuit of, yeah, let's try to make you not gay by doing these interventions. Again, that we have to inform the clients of really what do we as psychologists, as social workers, what do we know about the science and what do we not know about the science? So I do think a lot of people in the 60s and 70s, 80s, 90s, even currently, we seem to think we know it all and we can do something for this particular client. But my job is to inform the client of what's going on, understand what's going on with the client, and what's possible and what's also not possible. Because we have to also grieve. We can't have it all. So if I really can't change my sexual orientation, I need a therapist who's going to help me live with that in a positive way that works for me. And that's what I think we can keep transcending this way or that way or ex-gay or bro-gay, just really what works for everyone across the board.
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe I'm a bit naive because I just assume that a person is going to go to a therapist with the intention of, I don't want to be this way, I want to change. And they're going to encounter somebody who wants to explore that with them. I don't ever remember, oh, there are actually people out there with bad intentions.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kegg. And our guest this hour is psychologist Dr. Lee Beckstead, who is in private practice in Salt Lake City, Utah. He has been dialoguing monthly since 2013 with his political enemies about sexual, gender, and faith diversity. We're going to take a short commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative. Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kegg. And our guest this hour is Dr. Lee Beckstead. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, the affirmative side. People can be aggressive in their affirmative approach, saying, oh, you shouldn't stay married, or that religion is really harmful, or all mixed orientation relations fail, so leave your spouse. I think we can also, on the other side, be aggressive in our interventions, again, promoting one identity over the other. And what I really, again, part of my work of dialogue with my enemies is we did come up with a clinical common ground. So based upon this decade and or so of dialoguing with these people, we found approaches, interventions, a bigger broad way of what can we do when someone's struggling with this to not cause harm to anybody across the spectrum. So that's where I really want to keep promoting that idea that there are things that we can do instead of doing the extremes.
What are some of the things that you came to common ground on? If you could share just a couple of things.
Yeah, well, that idea is don't encourage or discourage one identity over another. So don't say, you know, don't encourage a transgender identity. Don't encourage a cisgender identity. Don't discourage or direct the person to really to say that what I mentioned earlier is I don't know what is going to happen with this client. So I don't know the client's trajectory. And so it really is just to explore the sources of distress. And that's what we can do as therapists is we have ways to assess the psychological distress. So what's the anxiety, depression? Let's focus on using psychological interventions for those things, reduce traumatic experiences, and then see what emerges. So that's also, we know that self-acceptance is very powerful, self-compassion, mindfulness, all these things that we do know work. That's what I wish people would focus more on. And again, this identity development. And affirmative interventions, I think, have been misunderstood as promoting an identity, which can be part of that. It's not really promoting, but really affirmative interventions should be about reducing minority stress. And that has two parts to it of I'm going to assess how you've been oppressed by negative messages, by stigma. I'm going to see also how you've not been helped. So like the null environment. So I'm going to provide safety. I'm going to provide accurate information. So that's what I wish people were more focused on, is reducing the negative effects of minority stress.
Did you expect to have some backlash when you started to do your research just because of the topic itself?
Oh, yeah. I've backlash doing the research, but working with my enemies, doing the dialoguing with them. I think something starts to happen. People start getting suspicious if you hang out with the other side. So I like hearing the negative gossip about myself of, you know, that I've switched sides or I'm no longer on our side. But again, I really want to focus on, I'm trying to find common ground so we can all work together. And that's going to start creating peace. That's really this idea of building peace inside of you and within your relationships and structurally as well. But it's also to understand the backlash. It's going to be part of this.
I find that so interesting because Xander and I have had previously conversations with other guests where we also recognize very likely that because of our trans community, we can't all be on the same side of the fence. And so there can be some stressful moments for people who may have been pitted in one of these classified bits of, for terms of, I think, putting people in boxes. They're reclassified by their own community. And I think that can be very dauntingly harmful, and it can create a lot of separation for many people. And the difficulty people have in being able to even allow time and the energy and the space to be able to have those differences because of the cancel culture today.
Mm-hmm. There's so much fragmenting that's happening within the community, within relationships, families, within professions, between communities. Again, this idea of you're not promoting my side, then you must be against me. I remember when dialoguing back in this Reconciliation Growth Project group with my enemies, and we were saying my side, your side, and one of my colleagues said, wait a minute, we're all on the same side. That's what we got to keep understanding, that we're all on the same side trying to understand these issues, trying to help each other out. So yes, that's one of the harmful side effects is when we start picking sides. I really wish that if we're going to create an us, that we don't create a them. So that's what I hope people keep realizing. But also maybe this is where I put in this work with sexual abuse survivors. The sexual abuse can really fragment people. And really all of us have a sense of there's an inner critic inside me, or there's a part of me that doesn't like me, or this fragmenting inside. Sometimes people work with trying to talk back at the inner critic. You know, you're supposed to oppose or overcome the inner critic. And I like, again, this idea that if you really want peace inside, we need to turn our attention in a loving way to these parts of ourselves, even if they want to harm us or they're really cruel parts, that we need to befriend these perpetrator parts inside of us and then collaborate with these parts so there's more peace inside. I think that fits also socially. These enemies, we need to find ways to befriend them and work with them in a safe way.
I was talking with somebody recently about how we live in a society that's pluralistic. There are people that live in this country who have come from all over the world, who worship differently and speak different languages and have different views on a lot of different things, but we coexist to the degree to which we do, right? And sometimes there's going to be conflict because we're so very different from each other. But when we can coexist and just tolerate those differences, because it doesn't make any sense to try and convince me that I must accept something that I find abhorrent, but it does make sense to me to get me to a place where I can coexist with people who behave in ways or have beliefs that I might find oppositional, as long as they're not committing a crime, right? We're talking within normal bounds. Mm-hmm. But I think what's happened is that the idea of toleration has been denigrated, and what has been attempting to replace it in a lot of ways are acceptance and celebration, which I think it's great. Like, I don't want to just be tolerated. I want to be celebrated. I want to be appreciated. I want to be welcome. I want to be included. But I don't want any of those things if it's being forced or coerced on another person or another group of people. I think that's a really hard thing for people to grasp, is that biblically we say love our enemies, right? Love your enemies, right? The idea is that if we are to coexist peacefully, there are certain things that we just need to let alone. And I feel like part of what's happened, the trajectory of, let's say, gay rights movement, right, and the securing of legal rights and social acceptance, that we hit a certain point where it was like, yeah, we're good, but it kept going, it kept going. And I think then we hit a certain tipping point where all of a sudden people started saying, oh, wait, no, nope, not that, not those people, not that thing. And I think that's a hard thing to come to terms with, which is, how far is too far? Is there a tipping point? Can coexistence exist when people get very distinctively different from each other? It gets harder and harder, I think, to work on peace building efforts. And I don't know if you agree, either one of you, Ann or Lee, if we're in a situation, not for the first time, but in our country, where there seems to be a proliferation of uniqueness, which is going to be really difficult then to find cohesion and coexistence and solidarity within. I think it's going to create more conflict that can lead to then violence.
Yeah. Everything you're saying, the way I categorize, I like simplicity. And I really like what John Gottman has done with couples research. We have three options. And this is from John Gottman's research with couples satisfaction and longevity. As I mentioned before, we can turn toward away, or against? And it helps me to think, am I turning toward you? Am I turning toward my partner? Am I turning toward that unique person? Or am I turning against them or away from them? And there are lots of ways to turn toward somebody. And you mentioned a continuum of turning toward. I can accept them. I can acknowledge them. I can be curious about them. I can celebrate them. I can appreciate them. I can advocate for them. And there's lots of ways of turning against. I can deny their existence. I can hate them. I can try to kill them. And the variations of turning against and then turning away is ignoring them or pretending they don't exist. And again, I wish if we are going to have any movement forward, any peace building, if we can acknowledge how we are turning towards somebody or turning away or against. And that self-awareness, it also, well, I guess, first of all, it takes skills to realize to notice the turning away or toward or against, and how if you're thinking about the other person or yourself. So based upon my work and what I did with the book project is really define what assertiveness is. So assertiveness is I'm going to think about me in a kind way and I'm going to think about you in a kind way. If we're not assertive, so that's a loving power. If we're not assertive, then we're going to be passive or aggressive. And passive is a sense that it's a powerless love. So I'm going to plead that you're going to like me. I'm going to beg that you like me. Or with aggressive, it's a loveless power. I'm going to demand that you love me. I'm going to force that you think a certain way. All these efforts again, and having a powerless love is really ineffective. And having a loveless power is also ineffective, but it's negative coping. And I love this scale that I think his name is Stanislavski did in 2019. It's a coping circumplex scale. From his research, he really found out that all negative coping, turning against, will result in preoccupation. It's you're going to stay preoccupied with the problem, or you're going to feel helpless and give up. And that leads to suicide. So if you want to be effective in problem solving, either the conflicts within a marriage, within a community, within yourself, then you must use positive coping, turn toward the problem in some caring, loving, non-hostile way. That will always result in some effectiveness. So again, that's how I keep thinking about these communities and this uniqueness and what's happening currently. Am I turning toward, away, or against? Am I thinking about me kindly and thinking about you kindly?
It makes sense to me that people would go against, right? That they would have the against response because that's the natural response. That's the part of our brain that sends us the signal that we are in danger, right? Because we're coming up against an enemy or we're, right? And so it's sending us a signal and the sympathetic nervous system just responds. And so it changes the way we think and the way we behave, the way we move. And so the ability to recognize within an instant, oh, I'm not actually in danger. I'm just uncomfortable, or I'm not feeling like I belong here, right? It's not actually a danger. There might be an emotional safety issue, but not a physical safety issue. And so not everybody knows how to override the sympathetic nervous system, right? They don't have the tools, the strategies to do that. And so I would imagine that when you're talking with people about coping rather than succumbing to minority stress and also taking it to the next level eventually of inviting people in versus shutting people out, right? We shut people out because we are afraid. Our system is telling us to stay away from them. It's giving us the rapid heartbeat and the shallow breathing and the adrenaline so that we can run from them or fight them, right? And so the ability to override that is so difficult. And it makes sense to me that people are experiencing, like you said earlier, they're experiencing a type of oppression, or they're experiencing a type of marginalization or ostracization or rejection, whatever it is. And that signal is sending them that response to fight or flee. Mm-hmm. Unless they know otherwise, that's just what they're going to do, right? And I think that's where people who are in the helping professions, and we can teach people the skills that they need to then reduce that so that they don't get chronic inflammation and insomnia, which is going to just destroy their life, right?
Right.
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is psychologist Dr. Lee Beckstead. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
worst dreams aren't your enemy.
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg and our guest, Dr. Lee Beckstead. Let's get back to the show.
You're talking about reflexes that we're born with. And also, we copy how our parents and caregivers, important people in our life, we copy what they do. So yes, they said this is a threat or this is a danger, so we're going to respond in that reflex way of fight, flight, or flee. So yes, in order to think about myself in a kind way and think about you in a kind way and my enemy in a kind way, I need to have new skills of self-regulation. And I would say if it's perceived danger or if it is even dangerous, I am more powerful if I can be loving. If I can love you, not love you because you're lovable, but if I can feel a sense of love inside my body, I could kill you better than if I hate you. And this is what, again, resource Live Assertively from this peacemaking project is really how to, you said override, but how to replace the smallifying feeling of hate, that if I can come from the place of loving, of this openness inside myself, I am more effective. I can make better choices. Maybe that is even not to kill you or harm you or hurt you, but maybe dialogue with you in a more effective way. I like the phrase that my co-author from this booklet of Live Assertively said, instead of fighting evil, start good. We can't stop behaviors. We have to start a better one. So that's what I keep thinking, hoping that we can develop these skills to regulate ourselves inside so that we can come at our enemies or these conflicts from a place of loving power.
Xander, how did you meet Lee?
Oh my goodness. Well, Lee, was it through you just reaching out to me about working on one of the peace building projects?
In 2017 is when I started thinking I should work with my enemies and do a book. The focus was on conflicts about sexual orientation, and I just wanted to keep growing it bigger. And so I reached out to people that I knew were big in the field, and I asked them, who should I talk to? And then I would talk to my enemies, and I said, who should I talk to? So I just started gathering a lot of names of people. They said, oh, you should, this person has the skills. This person would want to collaborate with the enemies. And you were one of the people that I was told would collaborate with an enemy. Yes. So yes, that's, and so I've known you for a while, and I'm so glad that you're willing to be a contributor to one of the books in the peace building project.
Absolutely. You know, what's really interesting about this concept of enemy, if we had a whole nother hour, I'd love to just really challenge you about even using that term. But
Yes.
The idea is that I'd be the type of person that you would invite in because I'm not on the enemy side, but within the cohort of us not on the enemy side, I'm sometimes perceived as an enemy, right? Yeah. So it's this interesting enemy in the big sense versus enemy in the little sense, because I'm not a person who goes along with the expectations, you know, the orthodoxies. Mm-hmm. And so that causes a different kind of conflict. And in some ways, I think there can actually be harsher repercussions from within your group when you aren't in alignment than from the people outside who just expect that you're not in alignment with them. Mm-hmm. And we haven't really talked about one of the projects that I'm involved in right now through Braver Angels is, we're not calling it peace building because we work on depolarization, effectual depolarization, but it's just different terms for similar kind of work, which is focused within the LGBT community, right? Mm-hmm. This kind of enemy within, this friction, this tension, and this thing that's going on. And so there's a lot of struggle with this work, but I'm enjoying it nonetheless.
Mm-hmm, me too. Well, you're talking about that common problem is you're different and therefore you don't belong.
Yeah.
And we really need to keep framing this idea of you're different and We need you. So we're stronger together. We're stronger when we work together. That you have something. That's what I love about this, the book project, is I realize my so-called enemies, they have something that I don't know. They are working with conservative clients and they're successful. So they're obviously doing something that's helping these individuals thrive and flourish and feel good about themselves. So that's what I did. There's a sense of intellectual humility, but I don't know it all. So if I want to expand my effectiveness, and that's again what we did with the clinical common ground, then I need to find the common ground, or I need to pool our resources together so that we are stronger together in our effectiveness. So yes, I really wish we would change this idea of you're different and you belong. I'm different, I belong. And how can I, the value of my difference enrich the community? It's a very different approach than rather than cutting off your arm because it doesn't fit with your leg.
It seems really strange to me that we have this issue within our community, let's say LGBT community, because we're also the champions of diversity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But we have conditions on that inclusion and diversity.
Yeah, well, I think affirmative interventions have really, that pride idea is gay is good, being different is good, that sexual and gender diversity is good. Then I think later on these years, we started using sexism. We started using this idea of what's not good. So I think, again, I think affirmative interventions have been hijacked into promoting one identity over the other and discouraging people who don't fit a certain mold or certain identity. And that's what I like to reclaim. This idea of a pride, affirmative interventions are not about promoting or discouraging or attacking, but they're really about empowering people. It's about giving skills. It's about this inclusion that we're all queer and that we all benefit from this queerness, from our uniqueness. So yes, I really do hope we can get back to the old ways of you're different. Cool.
I was talking with somebody recently about how back in the 1980s, when I was part of lesbian community, well, in, you know, 90s, we could all get together, a big group of us, for some event that was like the lesbian such and such, a dance or a march or some kind of event. But we didn't delude ourselves. We knew that within this broader community, there were all of these sub-communities. Right. And the gay community has the same thing. There are all these little sub-communities. But when there was an event, we came together and we didn't, the vegetarian lesbians didn't force everybody to become vegetarian. And the, yeah, I mean, like we just coexisted. And I do miss those times. I don't find that that's as common anymore.
Yeah. We've lost autonomy. You're talking about autonomy. The people are free to choose and live the lives that they want to. I think back then we had to have this independence of forging our own path with other individuals. So this idea of autonomy and accountability, that if I want a good life, I have to do something to make it happen. And I think people started thinking about, well, if it's not getting better, then I'm going to blame somebody else. That's not what it was in the 80s and 90s. If it's not getting better, I got to do something to survive, to thrive. So I do think we have to go back to these values of autonomy, accountability, celebration of diversity. They're more powerful and loving and therefore are going to be more effective.
Absolutely. And we knew how to take care of ourselves, right?
Yes.
We were like, yes. What's necessary? What's needed? Okay. Who can do these things, mm-hmm. right? We advocated for the government to step in, but before they were willing or able to do that, we understood what needed to be done. I was one of those people in the lesbian community that was at many gay men's bedsides as they were dying. And so, but I find when I interact with people nowadays, what I hear people mostly referring to is the government, what the government does, what the government doesn't do, what the government gives us, what the government takes away, and I'm like, who cares? We know how to do these things for ourselves. We have our own neighborhoods. We have our own businesses. We have associations. We have everything, right? I could travel the world and only stay in like gay B&Bs. We have a whole community. And I'm not sure the more civil rights we got, more legal rights, more social acceptance, for some reason, it's as if people walked away from being service providers or, oh yeah, we don't need that anymore. I'm just going to go live my life. And I think now we have this either a gap or a lack of knowledge of what's available.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're now expecting everybody else to meet those needs.
Kudos to both of you for doing the work. I think it's important. I think we need more people to do this work. Every bit of this work is necessary.
We have to go back to compassion. Compassion is very powerful because when you're embodying compassion, you feel good. When you share it to somebody else, they feel good. It just spreads. So yes, I hope we start humanizing each other and ourselves. And that is the way forward.
Absolutely. You know, When I was 12, my father took me to the Transcendental Meditation Center to get my mantra for my 12th birthday. And I remember at that young of an age thinking, who cares? Meditation. And I was learning about people that were meditating and in the forests, in the mountains. And I was like, what good is that? And eventually I started to learn, well, they're starting with themselves and then it branches out from there. But I think it's because I was raised in in my particular family where the focus on the self was a negative, right? And so all of a sudden I'm being taught a completely different system that's saying, no, the self, right? And now as a social worker, well, for years now, the emphasis on self-care, but I had to learn that. Mm-hmm. That didn't come natural to me, but it's like a person in the forest meditating does impact the world.
Yes, they're taking care of themselves. And that's good. Right. They're probably going to relate better to other people. Yeah, yes. We again had to think about us and the other person. It can't be one or the other.
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm thinking about with the work that you're doing, and maybe also some of the work that I'm doing, is somebody asked me the other day on a different podcast, you know, where should people start? And I said, they should start with themselves. They should be their first client or their first patient or their first whatever. They have to get right with themselves. They need to be getting good sleep and they need to be nourishing their body and hydrating their body, and they need to be getting movement, and they have to start with themselves and then go out from there. Because if we don't do those things, then we're going to be less patient, less kind. We're going to be more conflict engaging, and then we're going to have more difficult times, and we're going to think that it's the world's responsibility and the world that's doing it to us, when really what we need to be doing is getting a better night's sleep.
Yes. Caring for ourselves.
Yes.
And that will make us more powerful and more loving. Mm-hmm.
So peace building starts within.
Yes, exactly. And spreads outward.
Absolutely. Lee, thank you so much for being on the show. What a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing that's having an impact at probably multiple levels, from your local out and stretching out because of the work you're doing with individuals, but also the books and things that you're doing and coming and talking on podcasts. Just really appreciate it. More and more people, I hope, are going to start listening to these messages of the inviting in versus pushing out and the peace building. We need that to catch on right now.
Oh, most definitely. Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk with both of you and get to know both of you better. And again, that's peace building itself, to building these relationships. Yes, we need more hope.
Great to meet you. Very enjoyable conversation. Thank you, Lee.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. You were listening to our guest, Dr. Lee Beckstead. We hope that you enjoyed this hour. Until next time, thank you for listening.